This is CM Mayo. Welcome to cmmayo.podomatic.com. You're about to listen to my lecture at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which was recorded live on July 20th, 2009. It was sponsored by the Hispanic Division of the Library of Congress. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here at the Library of Congress, of all places. It's so famous and so wonderful, but I also spent many, many days here doing research. So it's very close to my heart, and I'm really very honored. Well, first of all, thank you to Georgette Dorn and Barbara Tenenbaum, and all of you for coming. Well, I'm going to start just reading a little bit about the story of the story. The last prince of the Mexican Empire. This is not fiction. This is non-fiction. Once upon a time, or I should say, more years ago than I would like to count, I was invited to a lunch in Mexico City. There, in the dining room, was an unusually handsome antique portrait of a youth. Perhaps English, cradling a rifle. The scenery included a nopal cactus, and upon a hill in the background, as in a Renaissance portrait, was that Chapultepec Castle? Yes, my hostess told me, as our bowl of salad came out in the arms of the muchacha. And who was the boy? Agustin de Iturbide y Green, the Prince of Mexico. I had never heard of him. This astonished me. I was recently married to a Mexican, and I considered myself well-educated. I realize now that we supposedly well-educated Americans rarely open our minds to the rich complexities of our southern neighbor. In part, this is because we are lulled into an illusion that we already know Mexico. Our media drench us with ready-made images. The wetback, the bandido, and the bullfighter, and the mariachi, the narco-trafficker, the corrupt official with his Rolex, his yacht, his weekends in Vegas, the pobres and their sombreros and huaraches, the ubiquitous, truly ubiquitous, unibrowed Frida, and those sugar sand beaches, bereft of people other than, perhaps, long-limbed blonde models in bikinis. A prince. This meant an aristocracy, a theater for power, social, political, financial, economic, military. Certainly, revolutions have erupted in opposition to the idea, but it can be said that for many people, a monarch and, by extension, the royal family serve as a focal point for the identity and unity of a nation. To most Americans and Mexicans today, this idea is absurd. But as I write these lines, the Belgians still have their king, and the United Kingdom its queen. These days, usually, one can satisfy one's idle curiosity with an internet search. Back then, my search yielded nothing. A few months later, halfway through reading Jasper Ridley's Maximilian and Juarez, I came upon the chapter about the prince's mother, Alice Iturbide, or Alice Green de Iturbide. My surprise at finding my own countrywoman long ago at the apex of this Mexican aristocracy, both antagonist and victim, motivated and blinded by who knew what medley of ambition, avarice, love, borrowed patriotism, or naivete, so intrigued me. I knew at once I wanted to explore and expand the story into a novel. So, the novel. The last prince of the Mexican Empire, the prince is Agustin de Iturbide y Green, who was born in Mexico City in 1863 and died here in Washington, D.C. He was really a Washingtonian for much of his life. He died here in 1925. And his widow, Louise Kearney de Iturbide, lived until 1967, which I always found very moving because, of course, you could probably guess I was alive then. I was in kindergarten at that time. I didn't know her personally, but my point is our lives overlap, and I think for most of you in the room today, your lives also would have overlapped with hers. And so on the one hand, this seems like a very long ago story, but I think all of us remember people from our childhood who would have known people who were alive then. So it's not really that long ago, as strange as it may seem. This is a picture of the prince, and I'll pass it around so you can get a good look at it. This is a carte de visite taken in 1865 when he was 2.5 years old. And he's dressed like a little girl, because of course they dressed children that way at that time. I actually thought this would be the cover of the book. To my surprise, it wasn't, although I must say I'm happy with the cover of the book. But I thought he would be on the cover of the book because, well, first of all, he's kind of cute. And second of all, he's so surprising. You know, it's for most Americans, this is not an image we think of when we think of a Mexican. He really does look English. So he was the grandson of Mexico's first emperor, the Emperor Iturbide, who, at the end of the long and bloody wars for independence, he led the country. And unlike General Washington, General Iturbide made himself emperor, but it didn't last long. He couldn't pay the army, and Barbara Tannenbaum's wonderful piece on the finances of the First Empire are must reading for anyone who wants to understand why it didn't work. You can't pay the army, not much is going to work. Or as I like to say, he who pays the army controls the narrative. He was executed, to make a long story short, and his widow and children came to live here in Washington. So the Iturbide family has a very long association with Washington, and in particular Georgetown. But this little boy, Agustin de Iturbide y Green, was also, on his mother's side, the grandson of some very important people in this country, including Revolutionary War General Uriah Forrest, who was an aide-de-camp to General Washington during the Revolution. Now, most famously, and the whole reason for the novel, is that this little boy was not exactly adopted, but we don't really have the word for it. It was more like he was taken by contract by Mexico's second emperor, Maximilian von Habsburg, who, for those of you who don't know the really convoluted and complicated history, I'll put it in a nutshell. The French invaded during our U.S. Civil War and then installed Maximilian von Habsburg, the Austrian Archduke, as Emperor of Mexico. The problem was Maximilian had been married for several years to Carlota, who had been, to make things even more complicated, the Princess of Belgium. It's very complicated. But they had not had children, although they were young. They had been married several years, I think 7 or 8 at the time they came. And so that was a problem, you know, for monarchy, that's a problem. And I think that one of the many reasons why Maximilian wanted this child was also to co-opt possible nationalist monarchist sentiment coalescing around the Iturbide family. So the deal was not that Maximilian would make this child his son, but that he would make the descendants of the first emperor highnesses or altezas, which was a way of saying they were part of the family. Because all the royalty were all cousins, you know, they were all interrelated. So they became primos or primas cousins. So it was a way of bringing them into the family, although not like a son. And that he would educate the child. Maximilian was the tutor of the child, and the co-tutoress was not Carlotta. It was the spinster daughter of the emperor, the child's aunt, who was in her 50s. Josefa de Iturbide, Princess Iturbide, became the co-tutoress. And so she and the child lived in the court while everybody else, the parents and some uncles, had to go to Paris in order to collect their payments, their pensions. So what happened was the American mother signed the contract, turned over the child, and shortly thereafter changed her mind. She said, well, I can't live without my child, and got up quite an international scandal. And again, all the European families were interrelated. So this really was a source of great consternation and gossip in England and among the French emperor in exile. The King Louis-Philippe, who had abdicated after 1848, his widow, the ex-queen of France, was Carlotta's grandmother. She was living, I told you it was complicated. They were living in England, so they were all like, what is this? What is this? Why are they doing this? What's going on? And of course, in Austria, this was also a source of a lot of gossip. Why had Maximilian taken this child? What did it mean? So on and so forth. But also, the American mother really got up a scandal. She came here to Washington after Maximilian forcibly expelled them from the country, and went directly to Secretary of State Seward, who then sent her or invited her to try her luck with our ambassador in Paris, John Bigelow. And it did, in fact, appear, I saw it on the front cover of the January 1866 New York Times, and the accusation that Maximilian had kidnapped an American child. So it's quite a funny little story, but it's not really a little story. I mean, a lot of people have seen this as, you know, a little footnote from history taken. I would say, no, it's not a footnote in history. I would say it's actually really a novel about what it means to be Mexican. The prince is, as in the novel, is the main character of the prince, is not so much a human being, although he does appear, of course, as a cute little toddler, but he's a character in terms of an idea. The prince is the living symbol of the future of the empire. So what does it mean to be Mexican? According to the French, Louis Napoleon, who invaded Mexico, the Pope, and a large number of Mexican conservatives, Mexicans should be subjects, subjects of the crown. And the response to that, ultimately victorious, as we know, of course, was that no, Mexicans are citizens. They're citizens of a republic. And so it's a very different thing to be subject than to be a citizen, to obey as opposed to participate. So really what this novel is about is the idea itself and how the end, the last of this idea of the prince. So it's also a very complex story. By its nature, it's complex, which is why it took me 7 years to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the French invading, and why did that happen? What was the acquiescence of Spain and the acquiescence of England, the participation of Belgium, the participation, it was complicated, of Austria, of the Pope, and of course the United States being embroiled in a civil war. In other words, none of this is understandable if we don't look at it as a transnational history. So it's complex in that way. But as an American, I also find it very interesting, not just because the mother of the prince was an American, but because at so many levels, you know, social, political, military, you name it, you see how Mexico and the United States interacted in ways that we're often not aware of, but that were really determining to the outcome of the story, not just of the little boy, but of you know, the nature of the Mexican state and of culture and what the narrative is that we have today of what happened and why. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the research and why it really was a problem. The main reason it was a problem was that the story of the prince had not really been told. And I'll talk just a little bit about that. Writing a book is like climbing a mountain. One step at a time eventually gets you to the summit, though perhaps once, twice, or 100 times you might have to overnight in heavy weather or retrace a deadened route and begin anew. All my writer friends are laughing, yes. In my case, before reaching much of any altitude at all, I fell, to use a Mexican expression, into an eggplant patch. The Eggplant Patch was my initial reading of the main works on the period. In these, the story of the little prince is either erroneously or so faintly told as to be, well, it wasn't anything to hang a novel on. This is surprising, given the impressive quantity of research into the Second Empire, well documented in historiographies, most recently Mexican historian Erica Pani's El Segundo Imperio Pasados de Usos Múltiples from 2004. In addition, the rise and fall of the Second Empire, the Empress Carlota's descent into madness, and Maximilian's last days and execution before a firing squad have been told and retold in movies, TV series, documentaries, as well as plays, operas, musicals, epic poems, and novels. But never, apart from a couple of problematic articles, has the story of the Little Prince been told on its own. Back to that eggplant patch. Ridley, I had just mentioned his book where I saw the chapter on the mother, Alice Iturbide. Ridley claims that Alice first married Agustin Jeronimo de Iturbide, eldest son of the Emperor Iturbide, and then after his death married the second son, Angel. Where that came from, I do not know. In the Washington, D.C. marriage records, I found the marriage of Alice and Angel on June 9, 1855. And there was a Catholic priest in attendance, so we know it was... Okay. But never anywhere any evidence for her supposed first marriage to the older brother. And in fact, as ample documentation in the Iturbide family archives in the Library of Congress shows, the elder bachelor brother traveled with Angel and Alice from Paris to New York, where after many years of ill health, he died in December 1866. So the three of them were traveling together, there was just no way that story made sense. And here in the Library of Congress, where we have the Iturbide family archives, for anyone who wants to see them, are the microfiches of bills from New York's Clarendon Hotel, one Dr. John Metcalf, and for the conveyance of Agustin Jeronimo's remains to Philadelphia, where they were interred in the family crypt in St. John the Evangelist. As for Angel de Iturbide, the father of the Little Prince, according to a privately printed Iturbide family genealogy, he died in Mexico City in 1872, long after the end of the novel and Maximilian and so forth. So the best-known work on the Second Empire, and the first based on research into Maximilian's archive, which is in Austria's Haushof und Staatsarchiv, Egon Caesar Conte Corti's Maximilian and Charlotte, offers what I now believe is an accurate account of the Iturbide's tangle with Maximilian, but in the sum of a single page. Maximiliano Intimo, El Emperador Maximiliano y su Corte, Maximilian up close, Maximilian and his court, that's how I would translate that, one of the indispensable eyewitness memoirs by Maximilian's secretary, José Luis Blasio, similarly relegates the Iturbides to the briefest of mentions and further claims that, quote, the little Agustin, then 5 years old, was the son of Angel de Iturbide, who had passed away, and an American woman. Three strikes there. The child was only 2.5 years old. Angel was quite alive enough to have affixed his signature to Maximilian's contract. I saw the contract. I saw the signatures. And poor Alice, she did not even rate the mention of her name. There are so many, but one more example. Sarah York Stevenson's Maximilian in Mexico, A Woman's Reminiscences of the French Intervention, 1862 to 1867, a magnificent tome in all other respects, relegates the Iturbide affair to, truly, a snippet of a footnote apropos of Maximilian's flight from Chapultepec to Orizaba at the end of the empire, late 1866. I just shook my head at that one. What? Okay. I read, but in these works about Maximilian, the Second Empire, and the French intervention, whether a memoir or based on original research, when it came to the Iturbides, the story was always the same. Mystifying errors and vagueness. Why precisely Maximilian would want to take custody of the Iturbide grandsons. I didn't mention there was also an older child, descended from a younger son of the emperor who was at school in Paris, but I'll leave him out for now since he wasn't in Mexico at the time. So why precisely Maximilian would want to take custody of the Iturbide grandsons, and why Alice, her husband Angel, and his siblings would agree to this, at least initially, were questions I could not begin to address when the Iturbides themselves remained obscure. I knew there were archives on the Emperor Agustin de Iturbide in both Georgetown University and the Library of Congress. But I was still in Mexico City, so my first path out of the bramble was an unlikely one, and I found it thanks to Mexican economist and historian Eduardo Torrent, who granted me access to the Banco de México's Matias Romero archive. During the French intervention, Romero, one of Mexico's great statesmen, served as the Mexican Republic's minister to Washington, where he lobbied, gathering money and arms against Maximilian. In Romero's archive, among countless treasures, I found several letters from Angel de Iturbide, the father of the little prince, anxiously requesting that he and his family be permitted to return to Mexico. These are dated August 1867, some 2 months after Maximilian's execution. They were sent from Rosedale, near Georgetown, D.C. Some of you may know Rosedale. If you go up Wisconsin Avenue, where the cathedral is, just past Café Deluxe, you'll come to Newark Avenue. And if you hang a right, pretty close to the corner, you'll see an expanse of lawn. It's a dog park. If you pay a fee, they'll let you take your dog in there. Good deal, by the way. And there's a house up there. It just looks like a clapboard farmhouse. That's Rosedale. It's one of the most important historic houses in the district. Isn't it? It's one of the most important historic houses in the district. So that was my lead. It was from there I could just jump in and say, well, what's Rosedale? Where is Rosedale? Nowadays, if you do an internet search, you'll find the rosedaleconservancy.org, and you'll also find a lot on my webpage with photos and so on and so forth. But back then, there was just absolutely nothing. So as good researchers must do, rather than doing my research just on the internet, of course, I went to the Historical Society and Library of Congress. There are many, many different archives here in Washington on Washington history, and there's quite a lot about Rosedale. And of course, in going through that, I found out about the family. But just to give you a flavor of this, a long list of archives in D.C., Alice's family, the mother of the prince, turned out to be an old and prominent family on both sides. And that really is a simple thing, but no Mexican historian understood that. Not a single one understood that. And in fact, I even found recently a genealogy of the old families of Valladolid, Michoacán, which is where the Iturbides were from, which is a really very authoritative, very detailed genealogy. And they list her as Alicia Grin, G-R-I-N. I had no concept who she was. So anyway, it turns out that she was from a very prominent family. And this explains a lot of how and why she interacted with the Iturbide family itself and with Maximilian, and how it was that she could come and, you know, meet with Secretary of State Seward and go meet with John Bigelow. And, you know, she was an enormously socially self-confident person. I think many people seeing the name Green, as I did initially, would assume, well, you know, she was probably a sort of nondescript middle-class person, but not at all, which explains a great deal. And it gave me a start to realize, after several visits to the Washington Historical Society Library, then housed in the Hoyerich Mansion on New Hampshire Avenue, that it was Alice's lace-capped grandmother, Rebecca Plater Forrest, whose portrait graced the vestibule. I was like, oh, that was kind of surprising. Over on Massachusetts Avenue in Stately Anderson House, the Society of the Cincinnati had the records of Agustin de Iturbide y Green's membership, descended as he was from the Revolutionary War hero, General Uriah Forrest. And in the Library of the Daughters of the American Revolution headquarters, I found a copy of the 1861 diary of his grandmother, Anne Forrest Green. So it really was quite something. And I'd also like to mention, and pass this around as well, because it has some photos, this book, Rosedale, The 18th Century Country Estate of General Uriah Forrest in Cleveland Park, D.C. This was, I couldn't have written the book without this. It explains Rosedale and the family from which Alice and the prince were descended. So I'll pass it around if you want to have a look at some of the pictures in it. Unfortunately, there's no pictures of the prince or his parents, but you'll see his grandparents in the house. But of course, the most important archives and most relevant to mention are the ones here in the Library of Congress. We have here, among many, the Iturbide family archives, the Emperor Iturbide's archives, because of course the family was exiled here, which explains how they ended up here. There's also a nearly complete copy made in 1929 from of the Maximilian's archives, although, as far as I can tell, it does not have the file pertaining to the Iturbide family, which I saw when I went to Austria, and it's got some pretty spicy letters in there. And I wish I could have quoted them all, anyway. So in other words, I did a lot of original research on this, and so then the question comes up, well, why then did I write it as a novel? And the answer is, I just don't think that the character, the people's decisions, Maximilian's decision to come to Mexico, to take the child, the family's decisions to agree and then to not agree, I just don't think any of the story makes sense if we don't understand it on an emotional level. So the story really is looking for an emotional truth grounded in the best research I could do into, you know, the social, political, military, financial, all the, you know, the context. So I want to be able to say I've done my best for you to be able to trust the novel as giving you, you know, something that's true, but it is a novel in the sense that I'm really trying to put myself, and therefore you, the reader, into the shoes of these characters, you know, to really imagine, well, what would it really feel like to be Carlota? And I think so often that we look at famous, powerful, rich people, you know, as really, you know, well, he's a king, or he's a movie star, or he's really rich. You know, we don't really think about them as people. So to just kind of go into that meditation of, you know, well, what were they afraid of? What were, you know, what did they think about when they lay awake at night in bed, you know? To really understand that person. And then I think we can come closer to understanding what really happened and why. Of course, we'll never really know. And even if we had them here on the stage with us today, who knows if they would have the truthfulness or even the self-awareness to say why they did what they did. But I did my best with the novel. So what I'd like to do now is just read you two brief sections from the novel itself that were informed by my research, and in fact incorporate slightly modified but pretty much original documents that I found in archives, but to give you a sense of the story. This first one I'm going to read is probably, I'd say, the first quarter of the novel. It's not the very beginning, but it's near the beginning. It's from the point of view of the father of the prince, Angel de Iturbide. He also called Angelo. So it gets confusing how people had different names depending on the context. He was Angel de Iturbide, but he was also Angelo to his family and friends and to himself. The reason I want to read you this is it's sort of an illustration of how the dynamics of the family itself explain a lot. And these were really obscured until I was able to go into the archives. In this brief scene, this takes place in September 1865, Angel and his wife Alice, and they've turned over the child, they signed the contract, and now they're in the stagecoach, and they're on the road from Mexico City to Veracruz. Veracruz is where you would get the steamship to go to Europe. And they had to leave. So, of course, this was a form of forced exile. And, you know, and we remember, this is Angel de Iturbide is the son of the Emperor Iturbide, you know, who had been murdered, who had been exiled. So to kind of try to imagine what he would feel and what he would think. The only other thing you need to know about this to make sense out of it is that he's having a flashback to the 1840s and 1850s, when he and his family were living in exile in the U.S. The mama he talks about, of course, is his mother, the Empress Iturbide. Pepa is his older sister, and Agustin Jeronimo's the oldest brother. Angelo is 48 years old, educated by the Sulpician brothers in Baltimore, and later by the Jesuits at Georgetown. He is, if by nature, a stylish man, meticulous and guarded. He was glad to serve his country as a diplomat in Washington, but he has never sought to be a public man. Many are dazzled by the glamour of it, but he has always known public life is riddled with indignity. You lose your humanity and become a thing, a puppet to be loved or bashed, slandered, decapitated. Your fate depends on your fellow citizens, who can be noble friends or, when you least expect it, murderous ingrates. Whether emperor or president, you and your family are the property of the nation, and the nation is a Janus-faced beast. He had thought he had escaped the fate of a public man. He has heard of ships plowing into icebergs in the dark. Having to leave Mexico again was like that, sudden, implacable, horrific. Of exile, Mama used to say, is nuestra jaula, it is our cage. In her blacker moods, when she did not know how she would scrape together the money to pay the rent, she would rage, her fists at her forehead, valgame Dios, this is being buried alive. She had lost everything. She hated Washington, ese fanjal, this swamp, she called it. And she found living in Philadelphia unbearably cold. Madame de Iturbide, as she insisted she be addressed by all but her children, spent her days gossiping about Mexicans she had not seen in years, and in the convent, intriguing with the sisters over bureaucratic trivialities. With the exception of Pepa, for daughters, there was the convent. For her sons, her object was that they marry into the best families, that is, those whom she knew, and who had both titles and land enough to provide substantial incomes, which was tantamount to expecting them to find a phoenix in a hen house. In Washington, what Mexicans? Mama had a low opinion of Chileans, Peruvians, all those from down there. Spaniards were another matter, but in the United States, Spaniards of consequence could be counted on one hand, nay, two fingers, and certainly they had superior alternatives for their daughters. It did not help that Agustin Jeronimo was notorious all over Georgetown for once waving around his pistol at a brandy-soaked tea party. Angelo was nearing 40 when, like a spring breeze, Miss Alice Green, she of the golden hair and laughing eyes, whose dainty silk-slippered feet seemed to float over ballroom floors, alighted in his life. Nothing mattered but Miss Green. His every thought, every breath, every action was for Miss Green. He brought her flowers. He made her a valentine. And on her birthday, he brought her a corsage of orchids. In summer, they went to concerts on the White House lawn. In the autumn, the opera, and to National Theater to see a play. In winter, after ice skating, did she fancy roasted chestnuts? He bought her a newspaper cone of the hottest ones, fresh off the fire. He was not Miss Green's only suitor, and her mother, Mrs. Green, merely and barely tolerated him. Time was of the essence, for to advance in his diplomatic career, he would need to return to Mexico City, which he could do now that so many of his father's enemies were dead and Santa Anna in exile. He proposed to Miss Green, and to his joy, was accepted. He had thought her mother would object, but to his surprise, she quickly, though without enthusiasm, gave her consent. It was Mama's reaction that stunned him. From Philadelphia, she wrote that she had taken to her bed, prostrate with grief. Angelo replied in a respectful and soothing manner, reminding her of what he had already told her, that naturally Miss Green was a Roman Catholic. Surely she remembered Mrs. Green, a convert from Holy Trinity. Mrs. Green, he carefully added, was the lady who would sometimes sit next to Mrs. Decatur, widow of the Commodore. The Greens were a respected family in Washington society. Miss Green was the great-granddaughter of Maryland's Governor Clater and granddaughter of General Uriah Forrest, who had served with General Washington and lost a leg in the Battle of Brandywine. Angelo furthermore explained, underlining this twice, that he fully intended to take his bride to Mexico, to which she had agreed. I am certain, dearest Mama, that you will understand me, and you will find for your devoted son's beloved an honored place in your heart. He enclosed his letter with a train ticket that she and Peppa might come down from Philadelphia to attend the wedding. But he received no answer until the morning of his wedding day. My beloved son, it is clear to me that your head is not in its proper place. I pray to God that this letter comes into your hands in time for you to be able to refrain from taking such a step. But if against, underlined, all my will, you are resolved to disobey me, then you must never mention this woman to me. And if sometime you come to visit me, for my peace of mind, I demand your word of honor that you will never present her to me. That is here in the Library of Congress. So I thought, wow, what was the matter with this woman? And I, you know, but really after all my researches, I never found any reason why Alice would not be suitable. I really think this is more a reflection on Madame de Trebide being, there are many other documents and places that show her to be an extremely difficult person. Extremely difficult. And of course she had been through something really, really dreadful in her life, and that would have possibly unhinged her to some extent. Anyway, the family dynamics were very complex. So understanding that Alice came into the family properly married, and she had this prestigious background, but she was not accepted. And then on top of it, they went to Mexico, where, you know, she didn't know anybody. She didn't have her mother. She didn't have her siblings. I mean, she was really in a very vulnerable position, and she made the best of it. It turns out she had quite a strong personality. So I'm going to read you one last little section, and then I'll wrap it up. And this is about midway through the book, and this is showing Alice after she has reneged on her willingness to collude with Maximilian. She wants her child back desperately. Maximilian's response was, you know, to arrest her and exile her. So she and her husband went, as I mentioned, to Washington, and then they went to Paris. So here we are in Paris. And this is a section that, well, as I mentioned, I went into many archives, but one of the most important for the novel, apart from the ones here at the Library of Congress, was the New York Public Library's manuscript division, which has the papers of John Bigelow. And he left very detailed documentation about his meetings and interviews with her. So it was, this is a fictionalized account, as sort of a retelling, but it is based closely on Bigelow's reports to Secretary of State Seward. This takes place in Paris, in his office, in November of 1865. And now we're going to, her aim is to get Bigelow to get Louis Napoleon to intervene with Maximilian to get the child back. That's the plan. Now, the curious thing here is Madame de Iturbide now, well, the Madame de Iturbide I just talked about, the widow of the emperor, well, she died in 1861 in Philadelphia. So now Madame de Iturbide is Alice. Okay. At 11, just as the clock on his bookcase tings, Madame de Iturbide is ushered in. To his surprise, she is dressed most tastefully in dove gray with a black velvet collar, modest pearl earrings. He rises from behind his desk and comes around to take her gloved hand. Oh, I am very much obliged to you, Mr. Bigelow, she says breathlessly. Does he detect a hint of a Virginia accent? Do be seated. Where? He thinks, why, she's frightened as a rabbit. What was she imagining, that he would have her perch on the edge of his desk? There, madame, either one of those chairs will do. Her fine hair, fine fair hair, and the way she sits nervously pulling at the fingertips of her gloves reminds him of a friend of his sister's with whom he had once gone strawberrying. But he returns his attention to his desk. The blotter, the ink pot, his spectacle case. These he aligns with the precision of a surgeon preparing for an operation. Yes, he signals. She begins in a rush. It is not at all what Maximilian has made it out to be. It is a fraud, you see it. A fraud, Bigelow interrupts. He leans back into his chair and makes a tent with his fingers. From across his enormous oak desk, he regards her coolly. Are they not your and your husband's signatures on Maximilian's contract? A flush of crimson appears on her forehead. She begins, silently, to weep. I admit. She brings out a lace handkerchief. I had allowed myself to be dazzled, maybe a little, by the prospects held out to my child. But I had never imagined that a mother would be separated from her child in his infancy. And, Bigelow says, the indemnity of the Iturbide family has been paid. Like a coon cat in wait for a chipmunk, he stays very still in his chair. It has not yet all been paid, but more important, the majority of these assets and pensions had been granted long ago to the Iturbide family and were in arrears. I mean, they were not honored by previous governments. By the Republican government of Benito Juarez, as well as others. But, madam, pray tell, why should Maximilian wish to keep your child when you so evidently want him back? Because my son is an Iturbide. Had my father-in-law, the Emperor Iturbide, lived, had his government survived, I mean, you see, my son would be in line for the throne. My son is very popular in Mexico, and he is likely to become more popular when he comes of age, and that is why Maximilian considers him a threat. Your two-year-old babe is a threat to Maximilian. Yes. Bigelow closes his eyes, taking this fully in. How ridiculous is the monarchical form of government, he thinks, out of the age of moated castles and knights in shining armor. Bah, the stuff southerners and women want to read novels about. If they really had a handle on what went on in a European court. The interbred mediocrity and sycophancy, the waste, cronyism, despotism, the bald corruption that could make a boss tweed blanch. But, Bigelow opens his eyes again. Tell me, madam, exactly. Why did your husband's family agree to this unnatural intrigue, but he clears his throat. Arrangement. My sister-in-law is not on good terms with her brothers. She is very ambitious and has been bribed by the title of princess and a place in Maximilian's court. My brothers-in-law are here in Paris also, and they and my husband completely support me. Agustin Jeronimo, my husband's older brother, wrote Maximilian a strong letter of protest. But you and they signed Maximilian's contract. But not entirely by choice. You see, Maximilian made us to understand that our son could be taken from us by force. Last summer, the order was thrust upon us with no explanation to quit Mexico and... Madam, Bigelow places his hands flat on his desk. He feels a headache coming on. It would be better, I think, if you were to make a formal statement. He taps the buzzer on his desk. In an instant, his secretary, a stooped young man with the hard-boiled demeanor of a Vermont parson, slides himself onto the chair to Madame de Iturbide's right. Madame de Iturbide is still on the edge of her chair, but she speaks now with a voice so sure and clear, it seems to Bigelow as if her throat were lined with polished jade. I had sent some of his playthings and a note to the Empress commending my son to her protection. I had been promised news every day, but other than a telegram the first night that he had slept well, nothing. Not one word. She raises her chin and blinks back tears. This past summer, we were made to understand that our child could be taken from us with or without our consent. And when the invitation to this arrangement was made to us, I never imagined that my son would not have a mother's care. I had understood that in some years he would go to Europe for his education. But no sooner had we signed it than we were informed our departure from Mexico was not to be delayed by even one day. We threw together what belongings we could and took the stagecoach to Veracruz, where we were to board a steamship. But when we got to the city of Puebla, Bigelow waits for her to compose herself. I knew, she said quietly, I could not continue without my child. I returned to Mexico City in great haste. Bigelow keeps one finger over his lips. Alone? Yes, for my husband and his brothers would have been arrested. I traveled under my maiden name, Miss Alice Green, and in Mexico City I took asylum in the house of my landlady, who is the widow of Gomez Pedraza, a loyal friend of my father-in-law. She pauses here, it seems, to Bigelow, for him to take special note of this name. Doña Pedraza. Exactly. She took me in her carriage to see General Bazain. He had just received a note from Maximilian that a solemn contract had been signed and that he should take no notice of my suit. But I pleaded with General Bazain. I said to him, as a broken-hearted mother, I beg you to write to the Emperor again and enclose my letter to him with your own. General Bazain agreed. More than that, he sincerely regretted that he did not have the authority to take direct action, but that he would do all in his power to induce Maximilian to give back my child. She snaps open her handbag. Here is a copy of my letter. She unfolds the letter and hands it across the desk. It is my own translation from the Spanish. Bigelow hooks his spectacles around his ears and begins to read, but not without difficulty because the handwriting is sharp, with pike-like T's and cramped, spiked S's. He recognizes at once that, naive a creature as she may be, Madame de Iturbide is not a person to be trifled with. So I'll end here so we have time for some Q&A. But I will mention, I won't read it aloud, but in the book I reproduced the letter, which is pretty funny. Thank you. Questions?
Because I haven't done this type of research before, that at some point I would have learned something that I didn't know before, and so I'd realize, oh, I wonder if I should go back to this other research resource. Did you find that to be the case?
Do you want to repeat your question, because then they pick it up?
Oh, yes. I'll do my best to repeat your question. If I found that I went back to other things having discovered something, oh, yes, it's a zigzag. It's a labyrinth. It's nutty. I'll tell you, just to give you an example, the John Bigelow archive at New York Public Library, I ended up going back there, I think, four or five times. And each time I went, I thought I had exhausted, that's it, I've done my job. But no, I would discover something else here or there and realize I needed to go back. So it's a lot of patience. A lot of patience, yes.
Along the same lines, since the book has come out, has anyone learning about it come forward with any other sources that you didn't find when you were writing it?
Yes. In fact, there's one I'm really excited to read. Clark Kirkcaston, who I think some of you historians may know, gave me a copy of his very obscurely printed book from Monterey. There are very few copies made, and he gave me a copy. I was so happy to have it, where he has a chapter about General Almonte. And General Almonte was the ambassador to Mexico in Washington, and in the novel, I have him introducing Alice to Angel, the White House levee. He was, in fact, the guest of honor at the wedding. But it turns out that he was a very important actor throughout the story. He also served as regent, one of the three regents, before Maximilian showed up. So he had a lot to do with getting Maximilian to come. And then at the end, he was the Maximilian's ambassador in Paris. So he's a character who's sort of a shadowy intriguer. And I thought, you know, there's just not enough about Almonte. He's mentioned in all the histories on the Second Empire, but I really want to know more about him. And I just couldn't find anything. And then there it was. So perhaps I'll modify things for a second edition or something. But yeah, I think the Second Empire, as we were saying before out in the lobby before the talk, the Second Empire is really so complex. You have so many different countries involved in such a complex period that it's really endless. I mean, I wish I spoke Hungarian, because there's things in Hungarian archives. A lot of Maximilian's senior officers were Hungarians, actually. And the doctor who did the autopsy was Hungarian. I mean, there's a lot of Hungarians, as we were talking. And I'm sure there's a great deal in Italian. I didn't go into the archives in the Vatican, but if I had another lifetime, I certainly would. It's endless. It's truly endless. One of the things, though, that has happened at almost all of my readings, someone has come up to me, either in the Q&A or afterwards, to tell me that they have family souvenirs. That they have like a book of Maximilian's protocol, the etiquette guide, or that they have letters or medals or dresses or a cross or a little statue. There are a lot of souvenirs, and I think that this is one of the reasons why the novel really kind of taps I really do feel that it taps taps sort of a deep vein, because it's a story that's very confusing and mysterious. I mean, the Second Empire itself, and full of contradictions, and it's a sensitive one for many Mexicans, because many Mexicans today view this as a betrayal. Of course, a foreign army invaded, a foreign person was set up as a puppet emperor. So the Mexicans who colluded with this were traitors. And yet, you know, many very mainstream, decent people did in fact invite Maximilian and support him. So it's kind of analogous, perhaps, to our U.S. Civil War, where, you know, a lot of people are very, you know, it goes into personal family history to go back and look at that. So yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to publish your book in Spanish?
Yes, and I'm in negotiations right now, protracted negotiations yes, it should come out in 2010 in Spanish, yes. And I have a very good translator, I'm happy to say. I do speak Spanish, but my Spanish is not at the level of my English. So I have a Mexican poet translating it, which I'm very happy about. Yeah, I saw a hand up over there.
That was exactly my question.
Yeah, yeah, it's important that it be a good translator. Yeah.
This is a writing question.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide when you're starting to almost procrastinate and be second-guessing yourself, that you're so involved with the research that you delay the writing, and how do you get the confidence to just start writing?
Yeah, that is a tough one. I think probably the hardest thing about writing, as all the writers know, is procrastination. That is really, really hard. And I had many moments where I thought I was procrastinating, and so I would force myself to sit down and write, and then I realized, no, I need to do the research. I can't get a grip on the story if I don't know more about it. So my answer to that is, I think as a writer, we really have to cultivate our intuition and our self-awareness and really trust that. You know, trust when your intuition tells you, go look in this archive. But that trust comes from the self-awareness to know, am I trusting my intuition, you know, purely and simply, it's just my intuition tells me, or is it that I'm afraid my agent won't like it, or I'm afraid I'm wasting my time, or I'm afraid I won't make any money, or I'm afraid people will laugh at me? You know, all the fears writers have that tend to cloud our heads when we sit down to write. You know, I'm starting a new novel right now, and I'm already thinking, oh God, I don't know if I can sell this. Oh God, I don't know if they're going to want it. Oh God, I can imagine the reviews. and that's the kind of thing that makes you procrastinate. So that's what I would say. Self-awareness and trusting your intuition is really the answer, because there's no formula. Every project is unique that way.
One more question.
Is the book available here in the gift store or outside?
We're going to have it outside.
I hope so.
And then the other question, do you know which archive or library does have the material about this in Hungary? I'm going to Hungary next month.
You know, I don't. But I don't. Probably the Staatsarchiv in Vienna would have a great deal, but that's not Hungary. Well, I don't know, actually.
I will investigate that. I have good friends in the Academy, National Academy of Sciences, in the library, and I will try to find out and let you know.
Wonderful. Well, I would love to know.
What about Trieste? There was some material in Trieste.
Oh, Trieste, which is in Italy, of all places. Back in the day, that was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. That was their port, and Maximilian had his private residence there. So Maximilian's castle is perfectly preserved, exactly the way he decorated it, according to his instructions. And you can go see it, and I did. And I have an essay about it on my webpage, and it's, I invite you to read it. I think for Americans, I would especially invite Americans to read it, because it's not just about going to see the castle and how interesting that was and how revealing that is about Maximilian, but I went with my husband, who is Mexican, and I don't usually write very personal things in my essays, but with his permission, I did include him in there. And what was really interesting to me and enabled me to see the novel in a whole new way as I was writing it was to realize, you know, for a Mexican, the reaction to Maximilian is very different than it would be for an American. Because this is a person, Maximilian is a person who was killed. I mean, he was executed by a firing squad, by officially, you know, after a trial, he was condemned and executed by a government that was, you know, the Republic of Mexico. So in a way, I think all Mexicans, you know, are connected to that, and it evokes confusing feelings that were interesting to me that I had not thought about. And most importantly, in the United States, although we have many things to feel conflicted about, certainly, we don't have anything quite like this. So it kind of opened my mind to it from the Mexican point of view by going with him. So I invite you to read that essay, which is on my webpage. And I should also give a plug for my webpage if you're interested in more about the novel. There's a lot of photographs and links to Rosedale and various different things and genealogies. There's a great deal on the website, which is really easy to remember. It's me, cmmayo.com. Or you can just Google The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire and you'll find my webpage.
Okay, last question.
I've read that in 1866, that when Father Fisher, who was the confessor for Maximilian, when he returned from the Vatican to go back to Mexico City, he came to Washington, D.C., and some people thought it was unusual that because the U.S. government did not recognize the Mexican government, that his confessor and later cabinet secretary would pass through here. In your research, did you ever find anything about his stop over here and if he met with anyone? Why
you would have passed through here? Well, Father Fisher, he's asking me about Father Fisher, kind of like General Almonte. He's one of these dark figures who appear throughout the novel. He had a great deal to do with all of this, and a wonderful character for a novelist to have, Father Fisher. Father Fisher had been trying to make a deal with the Pope, because Maximilian, we'll run out of time. I can't explain the whole thing. It's complicated. It's all in the novel. But yeah, he was quite the intriguer. I did not find anything specific about his meeting with anyone in Washington. Now, he may have done that, but the U.S. government was generally refusing to acknowledge or receive any representative of the Mexican government. My guess is he probably did meet in New York with the Austrian consul, who was also sending reports, political reports, to Maximilian. So my guess is he probably did meet with him. And we do know that he took the ship with Prince and Princess Salm. And those of you who know the history of the Second Empire, these were very colorful characters, very, very colorful characters, a Prussian aristocrat and mercenary, and his circus performer wife, who was, believe it or not, related to President Lincoln. It's very confusing. They showed up at the end and had a great deal to do with attempting to defend and rescue Maximilian at the end. They don't have a lot to do with the prince, however, so they make a bit of a cameo at the end of the novel, but they're not really main characters in the novel. So I do know they came together. So when Father Fisher showed up, he was helping Princess Salm-Salm find her way in a very reluctant and closed society. She was not really welcomed. And that's about the extent of what I know about that. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Listen to more of my podcasts at cmmayo.podomatic.com. For more about The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, as well as my other books, articles, translations, writing workshops, and more, I invite you to visit my website, www.cmmayo.com.